Welcome to episode 8 of season 3 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm the film watcher, Greg Ralph.
So this episode, we're going to be caught up in politics, Greg.
Well, not so much ourselves as the people in these stories, but absolutely. So we're looking at films that have fairly ordinary people who find themselves at moments of great historical import. So we're looking at the Russian Revolution of 1917-ish, and we're looking at the coup in Chile in 1973, and also a People's Revolution in South Korea in 1987.
That's right. So we're looking at the 1982 film Missing,
followed by Reds, Warren Beatty's, I think, first directorial effort of 1981.
And then we get on to the 2017 film, which is 1987, When the Day Comes.
Correct.
So, Greg, let's kick off proceedings here with this episode, and let's tell us about Missing.
In September 1973, the left-wing Chilean government of President Salvador Allende was overthrown by the army and police. Chile's 40-year history of democratic elections and political stability was jettisoned in favour of a junta, a military government, later led by General Augusto Pinochet and supported by the USA. In the days immediately after the coup, American journalists Charles Horman and Frank Tarucci were separately arrested by soldiers and banished. This 1982 film focuses on the disappearance of Charles and the quest of his wife and his father to discover his fate. They are presented with a series of trails, some of which are false, designed to get them to abandon their quest and return to America to await Charles' safe return. The central character in this tale is Charles' father, Ed, a conservative who believes in the American way of life, a path from which he feels his son has strayed. He's also a devout Christian scientist who describes his religion as about having faith in the truth. Gradually, Ed's belief in his country is dismantled as he comes to realise his government's complicity in the coup and their lies about the disappearance of his only son. Jack Lemmon is just so good in this part. His speech about taking his son back, no questions asked, is genuinely moving. And this film should be better known as a career-defining performance for him. He was nominated for the Best Actor Oscar, but was up against other strong films and performances, Ben Kingsley, who won for Gandhi, and Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie. Sissy Spacek is also terrific as his daughter-in-law, Beth. She was nominated as Best Actress, but that was Meryl Streep's year to win for Sophie's Choice. And John Shea is good too as Charles. The mystery is why his career didn't take off on the back of this film. He played Robert Kennedy in a miniseries the following year, and then nothing much until he was Lex Luthor in the Lois and Clark TV series 10 years later. I saw Missing when it first came out, and it was an eye-opener for me. I went on to read the original book, as the idea of one government getting rid of another was astonishing to me. Well, that was a long time ago. Watching it again over 35 years later, after 9/11 and other events, I'm struck by the Americans' belief in their inviolability in the midst of the carnage. One of them says, "Don't worry, they can't hurt us. We're Americans." In hindsight, this belief seems more tragic or perhaps ironic. Director Costa Gavras is an assured filmmaker. He shows an incomprehensible world of bloodied bodies piled up in a cellar almost like an inventory, and Americans treating the regular shootings as background noise to be filtered out by closing a window or having a string quartet play. And in that respect, I'm reminded of Terry Gilliam's Brazil, which we reviewed in season one. Costa Gavras' stylistic flourishes can be a bit hit and miss. Some are quietly powerful, such as the camera panning up to show even more bodies on the glass ceiling above, or the photo of President Nixon watching over the shoulder of his lying ambassador, or an earthquake that reveals to the American hotel guests that the outside world isn't so safe for them. But other flourishes mystify, such as a white horse galloping through the streets at night, that seems to have a deeper meaning which continues to elude me. But Ricardo, what did you think?
Look, I didn't know much about this Chilean coup at all, so it was really an interesting watch for me.
Yeah.
Out of the three films, I think this one moved me the least.
Mm.
However, the film itself is very solid. Okay, Jack Lemmon's performance is very good as the father searching for his missing son, maneuvering through this political machine. He really hit that fine line between the emotion of the situation and just trying to get on with the search, which I think was beautifully done and beautifully nuanced performance there. But when he broke down that little bit, I think you mentioned that, when he broke down saying, "He's my only son,"
yep,
that really touched me a lot.
And in fact, two of these films where I was really touched was fathers about their sons. And you and I have spoken about this before. Mm-hmm. That resonates with both of us as sons and as fathers.
Absolutely. But I also like the way that the screenwriter, I think Costa Gavras won the Oscar for this film.
He was certainly one of the writers, yes.
Yeah. I love it. The relationship between the father and son, it wasn't perfect. He portrayed them as not perfect. I mean, I think Jack Lemmon was very critical of his son and his son's choices.
To start with.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is they never have a scene together.
No, they don't.
Even in flashback.
No, no.
And the mother is a removed character.
Yes.
She's on the phone and that's it.
Yeah, that's all.
And you don't even hear her voice.
No. Interesting about the flashbacks you were talking about, because the flashbacks, I think, were very well handled.
Mm.
I quite love the flashbacks because they just happened. It wasn't sort of an exposition. It was just happened.
Sometimes you had to work out that you were watching something from the past.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and because you thought, oh, is he alive? I really love the way they did that. But there's one sequence I really loved is when they're interviewing these two people on like a balcony, and they're looking out to the house they lived in.
These two old people had different versions of the story.
Of the story. And so they showed the different stories as they were going on in flashbacks, and then they were disappearing. And then it was going back and forwards.
Oh, so yeah. Are you linking the visual disappearing of those different versions to the disappearing of the sun?
Possibly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because he did.
Because Costa Gavras, this is the only film of his that I've seen.
Me
but
too.
It is a great visual style.
Mm. So Jack Lemmon was very good. I was less, I thought Sissy Spacek was serviceable.
But she doesn't have as much to do.
She doesn't, and I think that's the issue. I think in terms of being nominated for an Academy Award, I don't think it really deserved a nomination for this one. I think
I completely understand why she didn't win, but I still think it's a good performance because she is someone who is antagonistic with the father-in-law. There's obviously history there, and yet she'll turn around, you know, she'll have an argument. They'll both go with plants into the hotel rooms and then she'll go back. You can see it on her. And you can see how they just gravitate towards each other as the story progresses. So it's not a flashy performance. I mean, Jack Lemmon gets the showy stuff.
He does.
But it's a very good performance. Like, I find her very believable.
Yeah,
and
she is.
I haven't seen a lot of her films, and I'm not sure what I think of her more generally, but I think she's really great in this part.
I wasn't a fan of John Shea as Charles. You know what? I thought he overacted quite a bit. I actually didn't like his performance that much at all. I couldn't warm to Charles. And you know what? One of the real problems with me with this film is I don't actually know. I still can't work out why.
Why what?
They took him. Why he was murdered.
Oh.
I think it's all very, there's a lot of questions and not a lot of answers, which I think is sort of the point.
No, you're told.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the answer.
Yeah.
He was a journalist,
as was the other guy. Yeah, that's fine.
And he was, what wasn't as clear in the film was he was also a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
But he wrote for a leftist magazine called Finn or something.
Yeah.
So then he and their friend Terry, the friend of theirs, she'd come out from America, he took her down to the coastal town, down to the beach, where the epicenter in terms of American involvement of the coup was happening. And what he saw was that there were people who were military advisors, engineers, and he had seen enough and put together enough and taken notes enough to be able to prove that high degree of American involvement that wasn't actually acknowledged by the American government until the Clinton presidency, like 25 years later.
Mm.
So that's why the Americans gave permission. He was, dangerous, I guess. But for the Chilean soldiers, it probably is a little less clear.
Yeah.
Other than that, he was seen as a troublemaker, well, I think.
I think all three films we're going to be discussing on this episode didn't really do that well in explaining the situation enough.
Look, they vary a bit. I didn't not understand it for the...
It's not understanding.
For Missing.
Yeah, but it's more of the... For Missing, I knew nothing about that. I think you have to sort of do your own bit of research as well in terms of watching it, because I don't think they make it clear enough on first viewing.
Well, look, if it's not clear, maybe the reason is that Costa Gavras worked very closely with the family. So with the wife, who had her name changed in the film.
Mm.
So in the film, she's called Beth. In real life, she's Joyce. They worked closely with her and with both parents to make the film. So maybe they blurred it a bit as a courtesy to the family. I don't know.
What did you think of the music?
I don't remember the music.
It's very 80s. So it was very dated that way. Yeah, it's very dated. It's very sort of 80s sort of synth sounding, which was very of the time of like the 80s. It sounded a bit like Scarface, a little bit like that. So it was a bit dated that way.
I think I said to you before, I don't actually notice soundtracks by and large. Songs I notice. I'm very song-oriented, although I can't remember any from this film. But by and large, I don't notice music. And in fact, when we talk about Reds later on, I got a bit excited because it said in the opening titles that there was music written by Sondheim.
That's right.
I'm darned if I know what that was. I was listening for something. I didn't want, you know, West Side Story or Red Side Story, but I wanted to hear something. I thought, oh, that's good. That must be Sondheim. And it completely passed me by.
Yeah. Oh, look, I found it very interesting, though, on Missing, that, but just the whole situation was quite amazing. Here you have an elected president of the people.
Who Nixon didn't like. Nixon economically blockaded the country.
That's right. I mean, you had Kissinger say this. He says, Kissinger apparently said, I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves.
Well, I think that says it all.
Wow.
You know, Kissinger was one of the ones who was sued by the family afterwards.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I think all of these films we're going to be discussing tonight will warrant a second viewing, and I definitely will be watching this again. I did enjoy it. I thought it was a very, very good and powerful film.
The way it portrays what that world was like, you know, just the sheer volume, because I want to use that to describe what was being treated as inanimate objects, these corpses, the sheer volume of bodies.
Oh, that scene.
Staircase. Around the walls, room after room. These are the identified ones. No, these are the identified ones too. This room, we're not quite sure who they are yet.
That scene, it just tracks them along and you're just looking at all these bodies on the floor. Oh, my goodness.
But even in smaller ways, that anyone who was caught outdoors for whatever reason, when the curfew fell...
Oh, got shot.
Got shot or arrested. And people, you know, running down the streets or hiding, as the Sissy Spacek character does... The guests who want to leave the hotel because of the earthquake, and you see what looks like a mother, father and child go through revolving doors being warned, you can't go out there, it's curfew. You hear gunshots and then they sort of circle straight back in.
That's right.
And the number of times that it's a constant background soundtrack is gunshots.
It is.
And the way different people respond. So Jack Lemmon, when he first arrives, and even I think Sissy Spacek all the way through, they kind of... are startled, and there are other people who.
But then, by the end, they're not. They've become accustomed to it.
Well, that little action where the guy who works for the embassy closes the window while they're having a conversation, you know, because of the noise, like we would do with cars. Like it's just, it's incomprehensible to me. But I think the film does a good job of trying to get you to understand some of that.
The horse moment is quite surreal.
Yes.
Okay, and I think it's meant to be that because it is crazy. It's a crazy time.
Yes.
So I think it is surreal. So I when I saw that when they were going after the white horse and the white horse was and they were chasing after it,
I just thought
I thought this is madness. So I think
I wondered if it was meant to be a deeper symbol of like you know liberty or something.
Yes. Oh yeah. It felt I think like there's it was meant that to be something too. Else, yeah. Because yes, I can see what you mean by that as well.
I really like the opening and closing shot. So the opening shot is just a kind of a caramel-coloured background, but like a photograph, slowly comes into focus, and it's the sun.
Yeah, it's the sun, and you've got that that sort of...
Across the eyes look,
right? So,
and the final shot? Do you remember the final shot?
No.
So apparently, I was completely oblivious to this, but apparently Costa-Gavras goes to great pains to not point out what country you're in. And I knew because I'd read the blurb before I first saw the movie. But there's nothing to indicate which particular South American country you're in until the very last scene.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I find that really interesting as well. I'm not sure entirely why they did that. But anyway, so what are you going to give this, Greg?
For me, this is an 8 out of 10.
Okay.
It's a film, maybe that score for me is a bit historical in the sense that this really was an eye-opener for me. But having watched it a second time, it still stands up really well. And I haven't quite plumbed why you weren't emotionally touched by this. You were touched by the father. Was it the son's character?
I thought it would be more compelling than it was, to tell you the truth. I thought there were moments that were very compelling. But I thought, after watching the trailer and looking at that, I thought I'd be actually compelled a little bit more. I think at the time, it would have been a lot more compelling than what it is now.
Because it was much more shocking.
It is, yeah, that was back then. So, but I'm giving it a 7.
Okay, that's still a decent score.
Look, I think it's a very good film. I think everybody should see it. I think every one of these films that we discuss on this episode, people should see.
Well, let's wait and see.
Okay, let's wait and see.
Well, let's jump back in time now, Ricardo, from 1973 in Missing to 1917 and around then for Reds.
Warren Beatty produced, co-wrote, directed and starred in this 1981 epic, Reds. Based on a true story, the film is set in 1915 and centres around the lives of writers, journalists and activists John Reed, Warren Beatty, and Louise Bryant, Diane Keaton. After meeting John Reed for an all-night interview, the two get along very well. Louise realises that writing has been her only escape from a boring marriage, so she decides to leave her husband and move with John Reed to Greenwich Village, New York, where she becomes acquainted with various locals, activists, artists, including author and anarchist Emma Goldman, Maureen Stapleton, and the playwright Eugene O'Neill, Jack Nicholson. Everyone largely dismisses Louise as just another one of Jack's girlfriends. As Reed spends time away becoming involved in labour strikes with the Reds of the Communist Labour Party, he's obsessed with changing the world, and working so hard he gets unwell and loses a kidney. Being alone, Louise has an affair with Eugene O'Neill until Reed returns. Even though he notices them together, he takes her back and convinces Louise to travel to Russia with him to report on and be involved in the Bolshevik Revolution. The Bolsheviks, founded by Vladimir Lenin, were Russian communists made primarily of workers who considered themselves the leaders of the revolutionary working class of Russia. Here, Reed and Louise really connect, working together, writing together as Reed grows in popularity in Russia. Louise becomes an important feminist in her own right. Reed attempts to bring the spirit of communism to the United States because he's disillusioned with the policies imposed upon communist Russia by Grigory Zinoviev, Jerzy Kosinski, and the Bolsheviks. Look, it's a long film, and as you can hear, it's a big story told epically.
Epically.
But at its heart, it is a love story. Look, I think it's beautifully made. Vittorio Storaro's, his cinematography is just glorious. He also shot Apocalypse Now and The Last Emperor. He's a beautiful cinematographer. He nearly quit the project, however, because they clashed over the use of the camera. Beatty wanted static shots and Storaro wanted more movement. But they did work it out with the opening of the film using static shots with more camera movement as the film progresses. And they did work together again on Beatty's Dick Tracy, so all must have been fine. Stephen Sondheim, known for musicals, also composed the lovely score, as we mentioned earlier.
That'd be the one that passed me by entirely.
That's right, I know, but it's a lovely score. If you're tired, though, don't watch it, okay, as it's 3 hours and 15 minutes long. The pacing is not fast, but I don't think it's ever boring. I really liked the film, and the performances from all were first class, but I really loved Diane Keaton's performance. I'm a big admirer of hers, particularly her early work. I think they could have, however, been a bit clearer on the political side again. I feel like the writers knew exactly what they were talking about and didn't really think about the ones that didn't. I mean, all the political talk really becomes a bit gobbledygook after a while, but it's a film I'll get more out of on a second viewing. But what I did find particularly interesting, and what I really loved, though, was the inclusions of interviews with the witnesses, real-life surviving participants in the events of the movie. I usually don't like when films do this, but they were actually really great characters. The one thing I will say, though, is that I wanted to be moved more, particularly after 3 hours. Okay, but it's definitely worth your time, though, and look, it's not mentioned a lot, this film nowadays, but I think it's a very well-made piece of cinema. Greg, what did you think of Reds?
It's a long film. Almost as long as your introduction, I think.
I know.
Not that mine is short.
I thought it is long, but I was writing it, it's long.
Film,
I can't.
Any film where you open the DVD box and you look at the two discs inside, it says part one and part two, I thought we'd done the epics episode. it really, in a lot of ways, channels Dr. Zhivago.
We spoke about,
I think, last season. Mm. So it has an intermission halfway through. Mm-hmm. Not the last film, as Beatty, I think, claims to have an intermission. I think Brenner's Hamlet in 96 was the last.
Four hours, yeah.
Oh, I've yet to see that. So it's got the intermission. It's got the length. I think he was in a fight with who made Dr. Zhivago? David Lean?
Yes.
I think he was in a fight with Lean because Dr. Zhivago goes for 3 hours, 17 minutes. This goes for 3 hours, 15 minutes. And if only Warren Beatty had used that bloody song once again about I don't play in your yard, he would have caught up. And the other interesting connection, apart from thematic, between Dr. Zhivago and this film is this. Who plays Dr. Zhivago's wife?
Oh, Geraldine Chaplin?
Who was her grandfather on her mother's side?
Who?
Eugene O'Neill.
Oh, wow.
So Eugene O'Neill, played by Jack Nicholson in this film, his granddaughter is in the other one. So that's just a little bit spooky. But anyway, look, what do I think about this film? I think this is a film made by someone obsessed.
Yes.
So Warren Beatty first hooked into the whole idea back in the mid to late 60s. Mm-hmm. He started recording the witness interviews, which I agree are one of the highlights of the film. Hmm. They were recorded from, I think, the 70s. A few of the witnesses died before the film came out.
Yeah,
Some of them not long after their interviews. He was lucky to capture some of those.
They were great.
They were great. They were really well done. And what was interesting was that they originally filmed those against the black backdrop with a single light. Here am I going, I'm a filmmaker now.
Yeah.
To make up all those films you've watched, you know how it is. They filmed it against a black backdrop with a single light so that they could then put behind them a montage kind of background to lead into the next segment. And they realised that what they had was so beautiful. And Jack Nicholson tells a story where he went to see Warren Beatty to say, listen, I think you're taking on too much. You've written, you're producing, starring in, yeah. You're producing and you're directing. It's too much. And he went to Beatty's house to tell him that. And Beatty said, hey, come look at this stuff I've got, and showed him the witness's footage. And Nicholson went, you can't now hand this on to another director. So he just shut up. It really is a highlight. But it's a long film. And I don't agree with you that it's always well-paced. As a little example, there's a scene when Eugene O'Neill goes to the house that Louise and John, or Jack, I think it is, have just moved into, or in the process of moving into.
Yeah.
And he declares his love, and she says, oh, oops, sorry, we got married.
Yeah.
There was a scene that went for, maybe just a minute or so, where she's telling the men about the moving boxes. There was no need. I just don't think that Warren Beatty could stand back objectively. He was so invested in this story, which is a bloody long story. And in some ways, I kind of wondered in the end, what kind of story was he trying to tell? Was it the story of how their love affair developed and the domesticity and the roles of the people mm-hmm. back in American society back then amongst the leftist writers and artists? Was he trying to tell the story about what happened in Russia? Was it about the dedication of the two in those circumstances? They're all important stories, but it's just too long. And it's not that those parts of the whole story aren't interesting. To me, the most interesting parts of the story were not the love affair. I didn't particularly feel for them. I thought they were both great performances, but I just didn't particularly feel for the characters. And unlike the other two films that we're talking about in this episode, these were people who weren't caught up in circumstances. They threw themselves into it. But the interesting story about that was the naivety. Warren Beatty goes to Russia to sort out this little spat,
which
is very Life of Brian, Popular People's Front of Judea versus the Popular Judean People's Front.
Mm.
He goes back to try and get the endorsement and then finds out he can't leave. They're not prepared to let him leave. He is a captured show pony.
That's right.
So that story was interesting. I just think it's too long. Now, apparently, a few years after it was made, just give me a second,
sorry. He got 12 Academy Award nominations.
Right, yeah, so, but, you know, it's about artists, and it's long, and it's worthy, and it's got great cinematography.
Look, it's beautifully made. Technically, it's fantastic. It's perfect. On a technical front, cinematography, the production design, the costumes, it's gorgeous. It is really beautifully made, okay? Yes, I can think, in terms of editing-wise, they could have cut a bit out. I get it. I got the Eugene O'Neill love story, but I don't think I think he could have been cut out a bit earlier. I don't really see the reason why.
Well, Jack Nicholson was doing Jack Nicholson, and he was up for the Best Supporting Actor. His performance was okay, but he was doing him rather than Eugene O'Neill, I suspect.
Yes, well, I got that as well. I thought, he's Jack Nicholson. But Warren Beatty was, I really liked his performance, okay? And I saw it grow. I didn't think I saw him grow enough.
He was a very winning character.
Yeah.
You could see why people, even all those decades later, the witnesses, you could see why they remember, most of them, remembered him and thought he was...
Of course, yeah, I got all that. And but what a feat. I mean, you can't really... I mean, what he did on that film to do everything that he did on that film.
But is that enough?
Well...
So in the mid-1980s, the American ABC TV network... So the film came out in 81, so it's only a couple of years after the film came out. The ABC there wanted to broadcast an edited version of the film, and he wouldn't let them.
Oh,
so,
wow.
They saw it, and I respect, I think I get, but I certainly respect that you don't want anyone mucking around with your baby, basically.
Yeah.
But you can also see why the ABC didn't want to broadcast in its full length, because when you chuck some ads in as well, it's probably a two-night miniseries.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is. And it does feel long. I mean, but like I said, I don't think it was ever boring. I never got bored.
Oh, I did.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Really?
Yeah, really.
No, no. I watched this. I mean, I watched it in a couple of sittings, but I never got bored. I was never watching it going, oh, where's the clock?
I kept falling asleep.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it was a sleep-inducing one.
Oh, gosh, yes.
No.
Now, here's an interesting fact. The budget of the film was $35 million US.
Back then, yeah. Yep.
And its gross in the US was $40 million. Now, that's not counting worldwide stuff.
That's right.
But that says it's a very expensive film.
It is. Yeah.
What year was Heaven's Gate, which is the big disaster?
Oh, yes.
78?
That was a little bit.
So it's a bit after that.
Yeah, a bit after that, yeah.
But it's, you know...
It could have been a disaster.
Look, they made the money back and a little bit on top, and so I don't know about worldwide, but to me that says it didn't grab a lot of people. I think it was an artist's film.
Yeah, you don't see that many three-hour films nowadays. I mean, you can, you know, they're few and far between, unless you're Marvel or you can be 2.5 hours, you know. You don't see it a lot nowadays because, obviously, the longer the film, the less you can fit into a day of screenings at a cinema. So, you know, money-wise, it doesn't work. You know, the shorter the film, the better. So you don't really see, you know, sometimes you get a Tarantino. Tarantino can bring out a three-hour, you know, the Hateful Eight. And they'll do that because it's Tarantino, but you don't see it often anymore.
Do you know, I'm going back to my factoids now, do you know how long the original footage was?
Of how much they shot?
Yep.
Oh, it would have been a lot.
2.5 weeks worth.
There we go.
It was a lot. And apparently he became notorious for just retaking. And Gene Hackman, who's only got a small part.
Yeah, very small part.
Not paid for. He did it as a favour to Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
He got a bit tired, as a few people did, of all the takes.
Yeah.
And his perfectionism. And he said at one point, okay, this is the 100th take. I'm not doing 101st, so if this doesn't work, you know, that's it. And he could do that because, you know, he was doing it as a freebie for his mate. Diane Keaton and Warren Beatty were a couple at the start of this film, and allegedly, from a few sources around the film, their relationship decayed across the course of the film. Some of the end, they were no longer a couple.
Oh, wow.
And again, allegedly, she used the experience of that decaying relationship for her next film, which was Shoot the Moon with Albert Finney. And again, I can just see... And to me, it shows in the film that there is a guy who's absolutely obsessed with the story and with Russia in general, but obsessed with the story, really, really wants to tell it. And as we've talked about in the past, someone who writes and or directs the film and stars in it, I think it's a very hard act for them to be able to stand back with distance and say, am I telling the story in the best way I can?
It is tough. It is tough. And, you know, ego's in the way and everything like that. But he was passionate about it. And I think that, look, his character comes across as the passion comes across a lot in the film. So I think the film works just on that level. I didn't get bored, Greg.
I did. But I do agree with you about Diane Keaton's performance in particular.
Yeah, I think she's wonderful.
She is very good. And I can take her or leave her a bit. Like, I can find her a bit neurotic.
I can nowadays.
Or cutesy, but
her earlier
she's
works
very good.
In The Godfather as well.
Which I haven't seen.
Yeah, amazing performances where she does those. Particularly number two. There's some really standout scenes. And she's great. But I... But this here, it's a big role, and there was a lot of complexity to that role, and I think she was brilliant. I could read her so beautifully.
There were other actors who were wasted. Gene Hackman was wasted.
Yeah.
Edward Herman, who I always like to see.
Yeah.
Wasted. William Daniels,
Paul
wasted.
Sorvino.
Yeah, well, he had a bit more to do.
He did.
Maureen Stapleton, I thought, as Emma Goldman, I thought was going to be another one of those characters, but she hit her stride in the last third of the film. So she
did.
Came back.
Yeah, she
but
did.
But Edward Herrmann as Max Eastman was never given that chance.
No, he wasn't.
It was just kind of in a story occasionally, and maybe he was there because he was historically important, but having just whinged for a little bit about how long this film is, there are other bits I wanted to know a bit more about.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to give this, Greg?
What do you think I'm going to give it?
Okay. I think you're going to give it a 5 out of 10.
Okay. Do you remember what I gave Dr. Zhivago?
A 6.
That's correct. I like this more than Dr. Zhivago, so it's a 7.
Oh, wow. Okay, good. Okay, good.
I didn't hate it. It's just that I think it's too long. And I think it becomes a harder thing to watch.
Yeah.
Look, it took up most of my Sunday.
I'm giving it an 8.
Really? I thought you'd be higher.
No, I'm giving it an 8. Oh, look, I kind of agree with the pacing of it and all the rest of it. I do agree with you on that. But like I said, it's not boring. And I think it's going to warrant a second viewing for me. I will watch it again.
I could go either way. I'm not sure.
Mm. And now we're going to jump forward to 1987, When the Day Comes, the 2017 film. Greg, tell us about it.
Okay, and as usual, I'm going to beg forgiveness if I don't get these names terribly right. But linguistic student and activist Park Jong-chul died while being tortured and interrogated on the 14th of January 1987 in South Korea. Now, I mention that date not just historically, but because this, as Missing, are both films about things that happened in my lifetime, which is really interesting. You think about revolutions and big politics things as being ancient history. This I know exactly what I was doing at that time of my life. Anyway, he was tortured under the auspices of Commissioner Park Chau-won, played by Yoon Suk-kim, of the Blue House Secret Police, who was alerted to this inconvenient death just as he's receiving a presidential medal for his work against North Korean communist cells. Commissioner Park orders the student's body be cremated without an autopsy to destroy the evidence. But prosecutor Choi Hwan, Yong Woo-ha, is both suspicious of the request and completely over being pushed around by the police and by his boss. He engineers a situation so that the autopsy must happen, and for a colleague to drop the news of the suspicious death on an unsuspecting journalist. When the news breaks, the police do their best to cover their tracks, cremating the body, intimidating witnesses, and coming up with ludicrous cover stories, such as a healthy 22-year-old man who drops dead of a heart attack when his interviewer slapped the desk too heavily. But they lose control over the narrative as a continuing string of people refuse to go along with the immorality of this paranoid culture. The prosecutor and his colleague, a doctor, journalists, students, Catholic priests, Buddhist monks, a prison guard, and even the warden. I saw this film kind of by accident last year and was incredibly moved by the viewing. I was physically sobbing when the student's father wades into a frozen river to help his son's spirit move on, while wailing at his failure to protect his son. The film uses deep emotion and surprisingly comic touches to keep it grounded in the human reality, despite its sometimes dispassionate tone and documentary-style captions when new characters are introduced. Even the brutal Commissioner Park is given a backstory to explain his motivation, a story which is horrific in its own right. I cannot recommend this film highly enough. It's not for everyone, due to its brutal story and confusing array of characters across its 2 hours. I'm told that there are a number of well-known Korean actors across this film. I don't know their faces, and this makes the people in their story all the more real to me rather than just being characters. But it's also one of the most inspiring films I've ever seen, showing the callous depths and the shining best of ordinary humanity. So I've been nagging Ricardo to watch it ever since I first saw it. And so, Ricardo, how did you go?
What a powerful film. It was my favourite of the three.
Yeah.
It's beautifully directed and visually gorgeous. Beautiful cinematography and direction. You know, I was talking about the political nature of it before. I think it was just a bit difficult with the names. You know, I think some people, when they sort of first watch The Godfather, get a bit confused by all of the Italian names in there. I'm Italian, so I never got, you know, confused by that. But this I did. So I had to sort of just go, oh, who's that person? Who's that person? Oh, that's that person. Okay. And I think all of that confuses, because it's in another language, it confuses the whole political nature.
And you're not quite sure sometimes what in detail is going on.
That's
because
right.
of subtitles.
Yeah, I had to go back a couple of times just to watch another section and watch that section again to see what they were really saying there. But look, what a powerful film.
Oh gosh,
really
yes.
is. And by that end, the end scene, I was emotionally invested completely.
Do you mean the murder?
When the student looks onto the crowd.
Oh, Yeon Hee,
yes.
character on the bus.
On the bus, yeah. Which was very, very powerful. But yes, that father scene when he's putting the ashes on into the and wanting the ashes to
and
go into
stuck
the water
on the ice
and
flow.
Stuck on,
well, as I say, when I saw it, I went in with no expectations. I went to see it because I had to see a late night film because I took my son and his girlfriend to see another movie. So I had to go and see a different movie. And so there's a choice of two. Funnily enough, both Korean films, late one Sunday night. So I went into this, knowing it's political and nothing else. And in fact, I missed the first 8 or 9 minutes. Even so, I dropped into the story when the prosecutor's saying to the police, no, no, you have to do an autopsy. So I missed the earlier scenes and was picking up context. And even so, very early on the film, I was there. I was so engaged in the emotions and the story.
It's really interesting because that prosecutor
yep.
sort of leaves the film.
Until he comes back towards
Until
the
he
end.
Comes back towards the end. So I thought it was going to be all about him.
No, it's a chain of people.
It is a chain of
people.
And
that's what's so impressive
that's right.
about
it. Is,
it's a true story.
Yeah, the way they put it all together.
All those people are part of a chain of people going, no.
Mm.
Now, sometimes it's a big no. Like he really put his life and career, well, his career on the line.
He did, yeah.
Felt protected by his father-in-law, whoever his father-in-law actually was. But he was really putting his career on the line, but he didn't care. He was kind of over everything that was going on. Mm. But then you have people who are literally risking their lives, the jail, the prison guard.
Yeah.
The priests, the monks.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah.
There's so many. You constantly have these little titles come up, and it tells
yes.
you the names of the people. And so you're trying to keep up with it. But I'm going to watch this again because it's so good.
And I have. And what I was going to say is that having been so emotionally and almost physically affected by that scene of the Father in the River when I saw it on the big screen, when I came to watch it again in preparation for this episode, I was wondering, am I going to be affected by this or not, or as much? And I wasn't physically shaking, but I was in tears. And I was in tears a number of times during the film.
Well, there's the first time when the mother character, when they find out that he's died.
Yes.
And the daughter.
And that is handled beautifully because
it
the
is.
Father is sitting on, he's been there for a while. He's sitting on the floor of the corridor outside the room where the body's laid out.
That's right.
The mother's saying to him, you know, almost kind of chiding him, what are you doing here? What's, you know, why are we here? And while she's on the floor talking to him, sort of bent over, the adult daughter looks through the door, sees the body in the photo, and she starts having hysterics.
Oh, but then
the mother looks through, and then she's just so overwhelmed.
It's so real and
it
raw.
It is.
And that's what just gets you emotionally, you know, in that sequence. And obviously the death scene at the end is quite harrowing. In what they did.
And the fact that they show it to you almost at the end of the film, you see the aftermath at the start.
Yes.
And so you're not expecting to actually see the death. That's like a past event in the narrative of the
yes.
story. And then suddenly you're seeing what it is.
Oh, and it's...
And it's brutal.
Brutal. Brutal.
I mean, there's a lot of brutality in this film.
There is. Again, but that's a time. This was a time... I was really surprised. This is 1987 in South Korea.
Yep.
They're just about to have the Seoul Olympics.
Yes, which added pressure to the whole thing.
Which I had no idea about in 1988, right? I watched the Seoul Olympics. I was 11 at the time. I had no idea that anything like this was going on. That's massive country upheaval when they're about to have the Olympics, which is meant to be about to bringing each other together.
I didn't know the stories either. Mm. But that's one of the things I love about this film. It's one of those things that happens sometimes in your life where there's this thing you have no understanding of, no awareness,
that's right.
and then it just opens a door. So knowing nothing about South Korean society, I'm not even sure I've necessarily seen another South Korean film before, and I hear all about this key moment. I start to understand the history of North Korea. That is one thing I liked about Reds, actually, is that it really helped me to understand why, from the very beginnings, the Soviet government, post-revolution, was so unhappy with America because of what they were doing in terms of blockading them. So these films do a really good job of giving at least me, a sense of history that I never knew.
Yeah, me too.
And this film really was like a door opening.
Yeah, yeah. And it was interesting because all three films are dealing with some revolution upheaval towards, you know, against the government at the same time. So watching all three of them is quite overwhelming.
When you said that the final scene of the film was the one that moved you, well, that is on one level true, but the other is, but there were other scenes. During the end credits, you watched those?
I did.
There was the footage of the real people.
Of the real people, the funeral of that boy who had a romantic, connection with.
And that photo of him, which they reproduced in the film and then shown the credits, of where he's almost in a crucifixion pose, being held up by a friend and bleeding.
That's
after
right.
being hit in the back of the head with a tear gas canister as a direct shot. I don't know, but I would expect that photo is very iconic in South Korea.
Absolutely. I'd say so too.
I just want to come back to what I was saying in the introduction, that this film is unexpectedly funny in parts as well, particularly in some of the early scenes. So the whole story about the heart attack because someone, you know, slammed the table too hard.
Oh, yes.
Even the student getting excited about being given a Walkman, which to us is now so dated.
Yeah, that's right.
And I can't bring that once to mind, but there were just a number of times where I really felt like I was veering between deep felt emotion and laughing. Yeah, and I think I actually laughed more this time than last time.
It's really interesting you talk about the Walkman bit because she gets given a Walkman. Because the film was so beautifully filmed and they didn't really make it. I mean, it's 87, but they didn't really make it. You don't really notice that the people are dressed in 1987 clothes or anything. They haven't really gone period on it in terms of that. I didn't really notice that it was 87. You know, so when she got given the Walkman, because it's filmed so beautifully, like a film today, it could have been shot today with the setting and whatnot, I thought, oh, she's into retro things. I completely forgot. Then I went, oh no, it's 1987. That is. I thought it was like records now, like, you know, coming back.
Ironic. What I was more struck this time around as well by was the amount of very casual violence. So even the prosecutor, who's basically a good guy, a hero in the story, is hitting one of his subordinates over the head
with
when you first meet him
for
refilling bottles with alcohol, with like paint terps or something.
That's right, yeah.
So there was that going on. There was the way the secret police would just push people around and intimidate them. The way they treated the grieving family was just off the scale.
Yeah.
But even when they go into the church, and hold the priest's head down, I think, on the pew. Or even in the Buddhist temple before that, that there's no sense of respect for that kind of spirituality.
No.
The way they treated the prison warden in his own prison, no respect for institutions. But it's actually quite satisfying that when they get arrested at the end and end up in that same prison, having to face that prosecutor and in the care of the warden, who they really treated very badly.
They did.
There was a sense of, I guess, schadenfreude, like I really feel good about the fact that, they got their comeuppance.
Of course. But you know what? You mentioned it before about the backstory, which
of the commissioner,
which was a horrible backstory.
Oh, yes.
And told very well, but also, you know, threatening it on that person, knowing how bad it was.
And the way that the secret police turned on each other, that when they lost control of the story and it's getting out in the public and people are starting to realise that something really bad has happened, they ambush their own police and arrest, first of all, the two or three of them as scapegoats and say, look, we'll look after you, we'll give you money. And when one of them turns around and says, no, that amount of money for 10 years of my life, not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then he pushes him down the ground and gets his gun out. And the guy's saying, kill me, kill me.
Yes.
He says, no, I'm not going to kill you. This is what I'm going to do to your family.
That's
this
right.
This terrible, terrible thing. Mm-hmm. And that
he thought he had the upper hand.
And any relationship they thought they had is just, it doesn't count.
No.
And then again, it happened at the end. I think that was kind of the nice police versus the secret police.
Yeah.
Again, some of these relationships were a bit hard to track, even second viewing.
Yeah.
But
and they are. I mean, it is difficult. You have still
as an Anglo-speaking,
yes,
ignorant of the history, it is hard to follow a story, which I imagine is much better known in South Korea, but it's still such a powerful film.
Oh, I loved it.
And the other thing I just wanted to say, and maybe this is me getting a bit political, but I'm a Catholic.
Mm.
And it's fair to say that the Catholic Church is not having a good time at the moment, and deservedly so.
Yeah, that's right.
All the stuff around priests and what they did to children is horrendous.
Mm.
And not in the slightest wanting to walk away from that. I also wanted to say, though, that in the film, the roles played by the Buddhist monks and the Catholic priests for social justice,
mm.
where these were people who were, in the parlance, were actively trying to live a faith that does justice rather in the real world, mm. rather than being some kind of rarefied ivory tower, admittedly 30 years ago in the story, but it was a really nice touch, not just that it was, you know, hey, the Catholics and the Buddhists were cooperating to achieve a greater good. And again, gives that moral tone to the story as well.
Mm. Mm.
So no surprises here for me. This is a 10.
Yeah.
This is such a great film that moved me a second time around. As I say, just the way it opens the door to something I never knew existed.
Mm.
I've watched this twice. I'm sure I'll watch this again.
Mm.
And I just say to people now, look, if you want to see a fantastic, deeply impressive, deeply inspiring film that maybe you're not even aware exists, this is it.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I'm giving it a 9 out of 10. I think it's a brilliant film. And, of course, it warranted a second viewing, absolutely.
Well, I can live with a 9.
So that concludes Season 3, Episode 8.
Caught Up in Politics.
That's right. Next episode, we are going to have our sports day.
Because you know how much I just love sports.
So
that's my rallying cry.
Yeah, that's right. So the first film we're going to be looking at is 2009's The Blind Side.
Yes, and then which is Gridiron Football.
Yeah.
Then we're going to look at a film for Aussie Rules Football to be good patriots, and that's called The Merger from 2018.
And not that's a new film, yeah.
Yep.
And then we're going to finish off with the 1989 film Field of Dreams.
And of those three films, you and I have both previously seen Field of Dreams.
That's right.
But not the other two.
No.
Okay.
So thanks for listening, everybody, again.
Yay, team.
Enjoy.